Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dave Driscoll of WOR's War Services and News Division speaking from New York. This week, the liner Gripsholm arrived in New York with more than 1,000 United Nations internees aboard, Americans, British, and others caught in Japan and other Far Eastern points when war broke out between the United States and Japan. These persons have been exchanged for Japanese nationals who were in the United States at the same time. Tonight, we have before our WOR microphone three correspondents of the United Press who were among the first to debark from the Gripsholm. They are Richard Wilson, United Press Philippine Manager, who was in Hong Kong on December 8th, George Baxter, Hong Kong Bureau Manager for the United Press, and Robert Belair, Tokyo Bureau Manager for the UP. Since setting foot on American soil yesterday, these men have been on the go constantly, attending press conferences and more or less adjusting themselves to what almost amounts to a new life. Therefore, we're indeed indebted to them and to United Press for their appearance here tonight. We also have with us Mr. Stanley Healy, who was traffic representative for the Canadian National Railroad in Hong Kong and was there on December 8th also. Mr. Belair, you've been asked this question, I'm sure, scores of times, but can you recount the events of December 8th as you witnessed them in Tokyo?
Yes, I'd be glad to. It'd be better to start, I believe, on December 7th, Tokyo time, when the president sent his message to the emperor, the final appeal for peace. Mr. Grew in Tokyo did not receive this message until almost midnight on Sunday night, Tokyo time, although it is known that the message reached Tokyo much earlier in the day and apparently was delayed by army censors until it was too late for our ambassador to approach the emperor. Mr. Grew called on the foreign minister shortly after midnight that Sunday and was tentatively given an appointment with the emperor for the following morning on Monday. But about 6 hours before the tentative appointment, news of the attack on Pearl Harbor reached us in Japan. We thought, on the basis of the way things were going Sunday night, that we might have two or three more days of peace until Mr. Grew had been able to see the emperor. But the Army and the Navy apparently had their schedule established, and they were not to be stopped by any final appeal for peace. On the morning war started, news was released in Tokyo first at 6 a.m. when the official news agency there called all of us. A few moments later, the police arrived at my home, and I was held there throughout the day, and the following morning taken to a concentration camp on the outskirts of Tokyo where I was held until we sailed on June 17th.
Well, during the time that you were in the concentration camp, did you have any opportunity to know of the progress of the war in any way? Were you completely shut off from all information?
No. Information did reach us in various devious ways. I don't believe at this time I'd like to say exactly how.
Well, I don't imagine the Japanese were too anxious to tell you officially about what was going on. Mr. Baxter, you were in Hong Kong, and of course that was a British Crown colony, and you were on the right side of the fence for the time being. But what was the story in Hong Kong as far as you're concerned on that first day? How did you know that the war had broken out?
The reaction came to us through a dispatch from Manila, which arrived much later than the official reports through the British channels. And our...
Well, I know that you're awfully tired, Mr. Baxter, and you've been on your feet all day, and I don't like to ply any of you fellows with these questions because it's been a long, hard trip for you. Supposing we come back to Hong Kong in just a moment, or let's go right on with it now. Let's turn to Mr. Healy, who was, as we said before, the representative of the Canadian National Railroad there. How did you know that war had broken out, Mr. Healy?
Well, I didn't know that war had broken out. I was in my bathroom shaving, and about 8:10, 30 planes came over Hong Kong and over Kowloon, and I looked up, and I thought to myself, well, we have some air support here at last, and all of a sudden, they dive-bombed Kai Tak Airport and flew over the house, and I saw the rising sun insignia, and I knew the war was on.
And what did you do then?
Well, I was shaving. It wasn't a close shave. It was a half shave. I didn't finish.
Well, we've heard all kinds of stories about the Japs during the past few months. First, that they were not good soldiers, which events seemed to disprove, that the army was poorly equipped, and so on. How about that, Mr. Wilson? You had an opportunity to observe it firsthand.
Their equipment is not very impressive to look at, but it serves its purpose. It's light, but all of it I saw, in fact, several items of equipment Japanese soldiers carry in the field, were novel and new to me. And I hope that we can learn a lesson from what we've seen of the Japanese equipment. We do know that Japanese equipment has been developed from what they have seen from other countries. There's nothing original about any of it. And while it's not the finest equipment in the world, it to date has served its purpose. And that is in taking territory covering most of East Asia.
Good enough.
Well, now, we've heard for years, Mr. Belair, that the Japs were more or less sick of war. That is, the man on the street was. Well, how do you think he feels about this business?
I think since the outbreak of war against Britain in America on December 8th, the spirit in Japan, even among the men in the street, has been quite enthusiastic. They were tiring of the China War. There were no great successes in the past few years, nothing to excite them. But they have had what they consider spectacular victories since December 8th, and almost everyone in Japan now is more or less swept off his feet by the enthusiasm that these reports of victories have aroused throughout the country. I think that we should not expect Japan to break because of poor morale internally. Their morale is good. They are fighting a race war. They want to run the world, and they are very much fanatically determined to do so.
Well, you raise a question there about wanting to run the world. How do they feel about the German participation in the war?
Their cooperation and alliance with Germany is dictated at all times by their own convenience. There have been many occasions on which they have refused to cooperate with the Germans when the Germans would have found their cooperation beneficial. The Japanese are deciding for themselves when and where they will move and when and where they will cooperate with the Germans.
By that, I presume you feel that the Japanese will not move against Russia, for example, unless they feel like doing it. They're not going to do it because Germany wants them to.
I believe that's right.
Mr. Wilson, you've heard about our production figures, and I presume you have fairly good estimates of the Japanese figures, although naturally they were hard to get. How do you think that we compare on the production line with the Japanese?
Well, I think in the matter of production that we cannot produce them in any single item or commodity, including manpower, if manpower can be included as a commodity. However, we have a transport problem, and we're not only trying to produce to fight Japan, but we have the European situation to consider as well. And I hope that we will be able to solve our transport problem and solve it rapidly so that we can put the items that we produce into active service as quickly as possible.
Well, how are the Japanese faring with the shipping problem? I think you said this afternoon at your press conference that the Japanese had suffered somewhat from lack of shipping.
They have a definite transport problem, the same that we do. However, they have one advantage which we do not have at this time, in that they do not have to transport their war materials as far as we do. As a matter of fact, we have to transport ours several thousand miles further than the furthest outpost that they, to date, or possibly in the future, will have to transport war materials.
Up to this point, what you've heard in Japan and the occupied areas, how do you think the United States is faring in this Pacific War, Mr. Belair?
I think we're doing as well as could be expected with the equipment we had on hand when this war started. The Japanese attack, coming as it did without much warning, caught us before our plans for strengthening that area had been completed. I think that since the fall of Singapore and the occupation of the Dutch Indies, and since General MacArthur's reorganization in Australia, things have settled down to a war of attrition there now, and that we will probably see this condition continued until we are able to build up a force either in the north or in the south to start a substantial counteroffensive. I don't believe there's any reason to be particularly discouraged as long as we are determined to make an all-out effort, especially in production of our war materials at this time.
Mr. Baxter, you were at Hong Kong and saw, of course, the fall of the city. There's been a great deal of discussion about air support and air power and so on. Was there any air support for the British at Hong Kong?
At the time of the hostilities started, I can say definitely that there's no air support from the British side at the start of hostilities. But the anti-aircraft fire was very poor. They followed along many minutes after the planes had passed.
Well, not being a military expert, none of us, perhaps we'd better not go into the strategic angle of air power too much at this time. Let's get back to Mr. Healy for a moment and talk about commercial business in Japan. That would be almost an impossible thing to estimate as to its future, but Mr. Healy, how did the American and British and allied commercial organizations close up and wind up their business affairs?
Well, we're caught unawares on Christmas Day in Hong Kong when the surrender came at 3:30 in the afternoon, and the first thing we all did, naturally, was to run to our offices to tear up any important documents that we would have, tickets that I had on hand, and that way we try to get things away from the incoming Japanese troops so that they wouldn't interrogate us on future things. And
well, I noticed you said to tear up tickets. You didn't think the Japanese were going to use those tickets
on
the Canadian Railroad, did you?
I don't know. They might want a ticket to Canada. I wasn't going to let them in.
Anyway, you closed up and tore up the tickets. Our time is running a little short. I was going to ask you fellows what you thought of the Zero plane, which has been so highly publicized. Perhaps we can take 30 or 40 seconds for that. How about it, Mr. Blair?
The Zero plane was developed from what the Japanese considered the best features of all other foreign planes. It is a good plane. It has performed on the southern front at least equal in performance to anything that we've put in the air now. I believe that in the long run they'll not be able to keep up with us in technological advances, and because they are now cut off from easy access to our laboratories and factories, and their spies are being brought under control in this country, I think that our planes very soon will outstrip them.
Let's wind up on this question, and we might all pitch into it. What was the reaction that you had when you first saw the attitude of New Yorkers and Americans in general here in New York? How about it, Mr. Wilson?
I was a wee bit disappointed. I came home prepared to throw myself into any activity in which I could help them. I wanted to help the things that we left behind in internment camps around the Far East. I was surprised to find the casual attitude that people have here. And I hope that in the course of the next few weeks that some of us can help change that attitude and put them into a spirit of everyone participating in a war effort.
I think we can all echo that, and you fellows have every reason, I'm sure, to feel as you do. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Richard Wilson, the United States Philippine Manager for United Press in Manila, who's in Hong Kong, George Baxter, the Hong Kong Bureau Manager for United Press, Robert Belair, the Tokyo Bureau Manager for United Press, and Mr. Stanley Healy of the Canadian National Railroad, who was in Hong Kong when war broke out and who have all returned to New York this week. This is Dave Driscoll speaking in a broadcast presented by WOR's War Services Division. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.